Hello and welcome to Power Pros Podcast, episode 108. I'm your host, the Hoff, Chris Hoffman, and with me is my co-host and nemesis, Pete Michaud.
Hola, Hoffman.
Howdy. We are back, of course, once again to talk about what's going on in the world of Nintendo. We've got some game impressions to discuss, we've got some reader mail to answer, and then we've got this week's big topic, which is going to be Nintendo arcade games.
Woo!
But first, let's kick things off with some game impressions, specifically of a game that came out a few days ago on the Nintendo 3DS, the hotly anticipated Metroid Samus Returns. This is, of course, tried and true Metroid. This is not just the return of Samus in the game's title. It's a return to form for the series, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. It's got all the action, the exploration, the eeriness, and the discovery that you can expect from Metroid. And sure, it is a remake of Metroid 2 Return of Samus on the Game Boy, but it is a from-the-ground-up remake. It's a total reimagining, and it's really only recognizable at the most basic level, the fact that you are going to the planet SR388 and hunting down the 40 Metroids. Admittedly, I never played all the way through Metroid 2 on the Game Boy, so I can't point out all the nuances. Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, I couldn't let you go on that one.
Have you played through it?
The original, yes.
Okay.
And it's really good.
Unfortunately, I didn't own the game when I was a kid, so I only played it for a few hours back then. I did play about halfway through when it came out on 3DS Virtual Console a few years ago, but no, I never played through the entire game. Anyway, because of that, there are a lot of nuances and things that have changed in terms of level design and ability that I couldn't really point out, but for the most part, it almost feels like a brand new game.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, this game was due for an upgrade. I mean, I remember...
I vividly
remember playing this game like on the school bus. That's how old this game is.
Yeah, I remember playing it, I think, in class.
Yeah.
Like I borrowed the game from someone, I brought my Game Boy in, and I was playing it in class.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was like third grade or fourth grade or something like that. Anyway.
But yeah, now it is back, and Mercury Steam did the development, but despite that, despite it not being made by Nintendo internally, I think it really does feel like a totally authentic Metroid game. And it looks fantastic in 3D.
Yeah, the thing that grabbed me right away was just the 3D visuals. You could tell that they just put a lot of time into making that look good, and it shows.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably one of the best uses of the stereoscopic 3D that's on the system. It's kind of funny. Nintendo is pivoting towards the 2DS and 2D, and it feels like we're kind of near the end of the system's life cycle, and here comes Mercury Steam with this game showing off, you know, some of the best reason to keep that 3D going. It looks fantastic.
Yeah, and I think like Metroid itself really lends itself well to a 3D sort of atmospheric environments, and you know, even like the first area when you land the ship and everything, like even the intro, you get those little, it's almost like these still frames where certain elements are popped out. The whole thing just kind of feels like a comic book and then, you know, super environmental backgrounds going on. It's pretty impressive.
Yes, it is. And I don't know if you're at this point yet, but once you get the freeze ray and you can shoot enemies and freeze them and then they sort of explode into chunks of ice and it shoots out of the screen, it's a pretty minor effect, but I still think it looks really, really cool. No pun intended.
Oh, that's awesome. I haven't even seen that yet.
Yeah, I'm probably a little bit more than halfway through. I think I've slain 23 of the 40 Metroids. And I'm certainly enjoying it so far. I know you're not as far as I am, but have you had much of a chance yet to check out some of the big additions to the game, such as the melee counter?
You know, a little bit. One thing that just stood out to me when I was playing through, I'm really not very far into the game. I just played really the intro area and just kind of tooled around just to kind of get a look at it.
Fair enough.
But what I've seen from the melee attack is that it's definitely a timing thing.
Yes.
And then I also like the, you know, you're able to kind of aim your shots with precision by holding down the L button. The analog stick then becomes sort of your cannon control.
Yeah, holding down L sort of, you know, it locks Samus's feet in place so she doesn't move around. And then you can just aim freely in 360 degrees by holding that button down, then just fire away wherever the enemies are.
Yeah, the combo of those two, like, it takes some getting used to. I was definitely, like, kind of getting whacked around at first. But after I got the hang of it, it really seemed like that's kind of an interesting mechanic for Metroid. And actually kind of breathes life into the gameplay.
It does. And I do really like the fact that after you do the melee counter, you then automatically aim at the enemy. You don't have to target them using that L button. It just automatically homes in on them, and then you just can mash that fire button and you can take them out.
Ooh.
I feel like it does make it a little bit more technical. So if you're not like a core gamer, it makes the game maybe a little bit less accessible because you are having to do so much of this melee counter and so much of this targeting with the L button. For me, it's not a problem, but, you know, I have some friends who, you know, they're, you know, more into RPGs and stuff and aren't really into the reflex-based action games. And I'm like, I wonder if they're enjoying this as much as I am. But it really works for me, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, it's cool. I didn't even know that about the melee and then automatic attack, but I like that. I'll have to give that a shot.
Yeah, it's very handy. Now, have you had a chance to use any of the new Aeon ability? I'm not even sure how you pronounce that word. Why do they put so many vowels in a row? The A-E-I-O-N abilities. Aeon, Ion. I don't know. Let's just call them the vowel abilities. Have you had a chance to try out many of those yet or any of them?
Can we call them the old McDonald abilities? Because
if you'd like.
E-I-E-I-O.
And sometimes why?
You know, I did try the first one you get, which is the basically like scan.
Oh, yeah, the scan pulse.
Yeah, and that's pretty cool. I like that it just stays on and you can kind of watch the gauge and you use it as much or as little as you want.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to see what other effects they use with that.
I think the scan pulse especially is really handy because, you know, you can use that and you can see, oh, is there a passage here? Is there an area here? Is there a, you know, block here that I can do something with? And, you know, that's one thing is that a lot of the Metroid games, if you want to find everything, you kind of might think about resorting to a FAQ or a strategy guide.
Mm-hmm.
But with this at your fingertips, there's really no need to ever do that and no need to leave the experience. I think that's really great. The later abilities that you get aren't quite as useful in the same manner. You get an armor upgrade that, you know, sort of makes you, you know, temporarily invincible until your Aeon vowel, whatever, runs out. You can get the burst beam, which gives you a really powerful rapid fire shot. And then you also get what's basically, you know, slow-mo bullet time for taking out fast enemies or jumping onto fast platforms and stuff like that. And it's definitely a new dynamic as far as I'm concerned for Metroid. I mean, I don't ever recall having to rely on, you know, meter-based special skills before, at least not in the 2D Metroids anyway. It's definitely cool and interesting.
Yeah, I think to your point, there is something about that, making it a little bit more like for hardcore gamers, there's this, you know, there's just these more like gauges to watch and things to be wary of. But I think it's cool. I think it's kind of a fun little update to the standard format of Metroid.
Yeah, I mean, Metroid is all about getting cool abilities, and this that's what that gives you, you know, more abilities. You got,
right.
You know, they're gauge-based, but you have more stuff at your disposal, whether it's better defenses or better attack or better exploration or better you know, level navigation. It's all in there. Plus, just in general, aside from that stuff, aside from all the new things that were added, you know, this game originally had some pretty cool abilities too. The spider ball, for example, is one that was in the original, and that lets you, you know, climb straight up walls while you're in morph ball form. That's one that's really cool and really handy and one of my all-time favorite Metroid abilities.
Right, and I actually think that one showed up again in, oh boy, was it Metroid Prime or was it Metroid Prime 2? But it showed up
I can't remember.
One of the Prime games. Yeah, you were able to kind of climb walls and all that.
Yeah, it's definitely a cool one. Now, one thing that I thought was kind of an issue when I first started playing is that it doesn't seem like there are quite enough save points. And when I'm playing a portable game, especially one like this, it's nice to be able to save and quit and come back later. And because of that, I was thinking, well, there should definitely be, you know, more opportunities to save. Plus, some of the enemies can be kind of difficult. However, after I realized that it does have checkpoints, very generous checkpoints, so whenever you die at a boss, for example, you always start right before that boss. Those, of course, are pretty much the toughest spots in the game. So that's very, very nice. I don't have to worry about necessarily going to a save point every time I do a boss fight.
That's cool. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, I mean, it took me a while to find out because, you know, at first I was doing pretty well and I wasn't dying and, you know, I was being cautious and everything. But, you know, inevitably I did end up dying and I was like, oh man, my save point was so far back. I was like, oh, well, I just am restarting right outside the door. That's very convenient. It doesn't really solve the problem of not being able to save on the go, but, you know, it's a 3DS. Just put it in sleep mode and, yeah, at least you don't have to do a lot of backtracking when you die for the most part.
Right. Yeah, that's totally nice.
Of course, another new aspect to the game is that it came out alongside some new amiibo.
Amiibo!
Ah, Did that get your amiibo senses tingling?
Oh boy, did it ever. You didn't pick these up, did you?
I didn't, but you know, I kind of want to. Is it even possible now?
You know, I still saw them over the weekend. Hopefully they are. Because they are, they're very nice. I really like both of these amiibo from a design standpoint. It is, of course, sold in a two-pack, and it includes both Samus and a Metroid. And it's got Samus in her crouching pose, like you see on the front of the game box. And it's a really nicely detailed Samus. I mean, you compare this one to the Samus from Super Smash Brothers, and while they're both, you know, authentic to the game they come from, there's just so much more detail on this version of Samus. It looks great. You know, the pointy parts on her shoulders look great. All the details everywhere on her armor. It looks great, you know, no matter which way you look at it, whether you're looking at it from the back or the side or the top or the front, it's just a really, really cool looking amiibo. It is quite excellent.
Cool.
And the Metroid as well, just also fantastic. A lot of people have talked about how it's sort of squishy. It's got this soft plastic that you can squeeze on the exterior of the Metroid. And I'm not sure I'm totally on board with that, because I feel like it's going to, you know, collect dust easily, and, you know, probably some number of years down the road, it's going to turn brittle or something. But that aside, it is a pretty cool effect. And it also results in the fact that there are no seams on the outer shell part of the Metroid. It's not like they had to take two plastic parts and put them together. So it's just this really nice solid bubble, and it's still got textures on and everything, and it looks really cool. And of course it's transparent. You can see the inside of the Metroid, and then it looks like it's, you know, breaking out of this glass tube or whatever it is. So it's almost like a little diorama, and yeah, it just looks really, really neat. I like both of them, and they both have significant in-game features. Using the Metroid, you can use it in the game to find out where the next Metroid is you want to target. And that could be really, really handy. I don't really want to do that because, you know, the thrill of exploration is part of the fun. But I did try it out, and yep, it certainly showed me the nearest Metroid, and I could see how that could be really, really handy. And then I think if you use Samus, it lets you unlock some sort of extra energy tank. And I tapped it on there, but I did not use it because I'm not quite sure how it works. I don't know if it'll have any drawbacks or anything, so I decided not to use that yet. And then after you beat the game, they unlock some cool stuff too. Like, I think Samus unlocks an art gallery, and the Metroid unlocks a bonus mode where you get to use the fusion suit, or at least a costume inspired by the fusion suit.
Nice.
From Metroid Fusion. So yeah, I mean, it kind of sucks for people who don't get them, but these things are behind the amiibo paywall, so to speak. They are pretty nifty bonuses, and just as far as, you know, collectability goes, I think they are great.
Yeah, totally.
For the record, the Smash Samus and the Smash Zero Suit Samus also unlock stuff as well. So yeah, if you have your Metroid amiibo, they are going to be put to great use in this game.
I'm going to try to hunt them both down.
All right, you should. You absolutely should. They are very nice. So overall, I am very much enjoying the game. It might not be developed by Nintendo, but you know, you can certainly tell that they had their hands in it, making sure this was as polished as it could possibly be. I don't know if anything will change as I play, you know, further into the title, but so far, so good. I'm really enjoying it, and certainly I encourage anyone who likes games of this nature to absolutely check it out.
Yeah, this is a solid one. I can't wait to play it more. I'm curious how long it is. I'm assuming it's more or less a Metroid adventure, probably clocking in about 10, 15 hours.
Well, like I said, I'm not that far into it, so I can't say yet. But yeah, it certainly seems like it might be something like that. Doesn't seem like it's going to be too short at any rate.
No. No, and usually there's always like some extra stuff you can do.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But yeah, definitely looking forward to playing more of this. Yeah, I would totally recommend picking this up if you are at all into action adventure style games.
Yeah, I hope it does well. I hope this is not the end of Metroid. I hope that it sells well, Nintendo sees it selling well, and they're like, yes, let's continue to pump out great Metroid games in this side-scrolling style. The other game I've been playing recently is Thimbleweed Park on the Switch.
Awesome.
Which comes out in the eShop today.
That's right. I'm actually going to pick this one up.
Well, I definitely think you should. In my opinion, it is a fun, clever, retro-inspired point-and-click mystery adventure. It's got a very cool throwback, VGA aesthetic, and it's got a really strong pedigree. It comes from Ron Gilbert and Gary Winnick, who were the co-creators of Maniac Mansion. And Ron Gilbert was also the writer and director on the first two Secret of Monkey Island games. So you know it's coming from people who know their stuff.
Yeah, especially in the point-and-click genre.
Yeah, yeah. And let me tell you, my plan when I was playing this was to like be tagging back and forth between this and Metroid. And so I'd be like, okay, I'm going to play a couple hours of Metroid and do something that's sort of action-y and reflex-oriented. And then I'm going to switch over to Thimbleweed Park and play something that's a little more cerebral and a little more calm. But what ended up happening is I started playing Thimbleweed Park and all of a sudden I literally played all night long. And I had put in 12 hours straight of playing this game pretty much.
So
I would definitely call it addictive and captivating. It's got some really great mysteries. It hits all the right retro notes.
No, it's great.
And yeah, I just kept coming back to sort of solve one more puzzle.
So what was your favorite part about it?
I don't know if I want to say a particular favorite part, because that would probably be spoilery.
Yeah, don't you dare.
But everything just comes together really, really well. It's a good size. I think I was probably, about 15 hours in when I, completed the game.
Oh, wow.
There's just lots to explore, lots to interact with, lots and lots of items to collect, some of which are just total red herrings. You can collect them for no reason at all. And it's got lots of, wacky references to other video games and stuff. One of the things you can collect is an Atari ET cartridge. Why? I don't know.
Nobody wants that.
And there's an arcade, and you can see Pac-Man, the Pac-Man ghosts on the windows, references to Commodore 64 and stuff. And most of the puzzles are just about the right difficulty. They're usually generally logical. They aren't too obtuse. There was one puzzle I kind of got stuck on because it was too simple. without giving too much away, it involves a post office, and I thought I had to send the postman a package to distract him, and then when his back is turned, I could do something. It turns out that's not the case at all. I was just overthinking. It's actually far more logical than that. However, if you do get stuck, it's actually a great built-in hint system. So again, kind of like Metroid, there's no reason to have to turn to a FAQ if you get stuck. And there were a couple of times where I needed a nudge. One time it was just because I had a character standing in front of something, and so I didn't know I could click there because it was blocking the item I needed to click on.
Got it.
And that hint straightened me out and saved me a lot of trouble. And there was another time where I knew what I had to do, but I had to search the entire game to do it. So I give up. I'm just going to check the hint system. And it told me where it was, and that saved me so much. I've always spent probably another 2 hours just wandering around every single room in the game trying to find where this thing was. And so that was very nice to not have to do that.
Yeah, in games like this, some people kind of rip on the hint system. But I think in this kind of particular game, you don't want to spend more than 30 minutes to an hour really trying to retrace your steps and try to figure out what you missed. And it just there's a very fine line between challenging and just I'm going to be angry. And so it's just nice that they include something like that.
And the way the hint system works, of course, is that at first it'll be something very vague and you can keep asking and it'll get more specific. And usually when I got stuck, I knew all the vague stuff. So it was just that last specific thing I needed. So I'd be like, okay, take me through those four simple hints. Tell me the part where I'm stuck on. Okay, all right, thanks.
That's cool.
But another cool thing about the game is that there are actually five playable characters in the game. And it's weird because at first you only start with two, and I wasn't really sure why there were even two, and then I was getting these flashback scenes that sort of distract from the main plot, and I'm like, well, why are these here? I can't do anything else while I'm doing these flashbacks, and it's kind of taken a while. But then it turns out those become regular playable characters after the flashback is over. And then it all makes sense. And having multiple characters is really cool. You can switch between the characters on the fly with the ZL and ZR buttons. And as you advance, it's really convenient to have characters in different locations that you can just switch to.
Cool.
Like, okay, I have a character here, I have a character here. Plus, even though the characters are mostly interchangeable most of the time, they do have some manner of unique abilities. And you have to sometimes use them in conjunction to solve a few of the more complex puzzles. And then on top of that, there's one character who's completely different, and he has access to different actions and abilities the other characters don't have at all. So that is also pretty neat.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's got good mysteries. It's got good writing. It has lots of breaking the fourth wall adventure game type of humor. And it's also a huge homage to Maniac Mansion.
Oh, nice.
So if you like that game, you will enjoy all the references. And it's not just references. It's also like some items that are straight out of Maniac Mansion, a couple puzzles, a couple, you know, architectural layouts in the environment, and even a few jokes that are straight from that game. So I think Maniac Mansion fans will certainly appreciate this game.
Nice. Is there a voice acting in this one?
There is. There is. You can turn it off if you don't like it. It also, you know, will print everything on the screen as well if you want. But yeah, you can toggle on captions and voice if you'd like.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And is there dying? Because I know a lot of these that you don't actually have like a game over.
No, this one does not have a game over. There are still a couple of good thrills, despite, you know, knowing that you're not going to ever get a game over. But no, you cannot actually die. You can't get stuck, at least not as far as I could tell. So, yeah, it's fixed all those problems of those old school type of point and click adventure games. I guess I do have, you know, a couple little gripes.
Sure.
And those are that I wish there was some way to cycle through all the verbs instead of always dragging your cursor down to the verb box at the bottom. I just wish that you could, you know, hit the X or Y button or something and just cycle through the 9 verbs in sequence, because, you know, sometimes I'm on a light switch and it's like, no, I don't want to look at it. I want to use it, but oh, I gotta, you know, drag my cursor down here. It's not the end of the world or anything.
Yeah.
But it would have been kind of handy. I will say it's really convenient that they have the left and right sticks moving the cursor at different speeds. The left stick is fast, the right stick is slow, and that's very convenient. It also has touch controls if you're playing in undocked mode. I haven't tried that out myself, but yeah, I was playing in docked mode the whole time, but it's there, and you know, I imagine for people who want to play it that way, that could be very convenient as well.
You can also pick your verbs faster, it seems like.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And I guess my other little complaint is that I kind of thought the ending was a cop-out.
Hmm. No spoilers.
And I don't want to say anything because, exactly. I'm not going to spoil anything. But I don't know. For me, the ultimate payoff was just a little bit unsatisfying.
Hmm.
But still, I really enjoyed the game. It kept me captivated the entire time. Like I said, I basically just couldn't stop playing. The $20 price tag just seems about right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for anyone who is a point-and-click fan, I do not think you'll be disappointed, especially if you were at all in a Maniac Mansion. So it's good stuff.
Cool. Yeah, I look forward to picking this one up.
All right. Excellent. I suppose we should move on to another topic then.
Yeah. So, Chris, have you heard about this? And this is totally speculation on a lot of people's part. But have you heard about this golf being sort of hidden in the Nintendo Switch?
Yes. Yes, I have. I have been following it super closely. But yeah, the story going around is that the NES golf game is like embedded in every Switch unit as a tribute to Iwata, because he was the one who programmed the game. However, from what I've heard, it sounds like it's something that's supposed to only be activated on his birthday, which was July 11th.
Yeah.
So it seems like it would be tough to get to for most people, at least for the next many months.
Yeah, this is a weird one. Partially, I want to believe it. You know, certainly it is on there, it seems like, and it's hidden under the name Flog, which is, of course, golf backwards.
Yeah, clever.
And apparently this was a game that was programmed by Mr. Iwata by himself.
So they say, yep.
So this is entirely like a tribute just to his sort of legacy. And, you know, I read this thing about it being, you know, sort of a Japanese thing to sort of make this like tribute called a omamori, which I'm not super familiar with, but it's basically a good luck or something that will protect you to the owner. So it's just kind of this like little Easter egg that they wanted to put in every Switch console.
Well, and I guess it means that Iwata was sort of, you know, watching over, you know, all of the Switches and all of Nintendo and all the users. So his spirit is sort of watching over the Switch and, you know, making everybody happy, I guess, which is, you know, a cool thought.
Yeah, it really is like this weird, like warm and fuzzy. Like I read it and I was like, wow, that, like, I hope that's kind of true, because if it is, then that's pretty awesome. Good tribute.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there is no normal way to access it at this point, I guess I'm probably not going to worry about it too much more, but I'm certainly going to keep my ear to the ground about this topic, and maybe when July 11th rolls around next year, we will all be able to play golf, thanks to Mr. Iwata.
Very cool.
All right, let us move along now to some listener mail. This first one, it comes from listener Shu, and he writes, in response to a question that we answered recently, if I could fuse a Nintendo property with a non-Nintendo property, I'd like to see Shin Megami Tensei, Devil Survivor, and Pokemon. Pokemon Conquest show that a Pokemon strategy RPG can be really fun. Another good combo I'd like to see would be Shadow of the Colossus plus Ice Climbers, developed by Platinum Games.
Wow.
Also, congrats for mentioning Star Tropics, but Dodongo dislikes that you left it off your Games of Summer list. Yeah, those are some interesting game combinations there. I find it hard to imagine seeing Pokemon with Devil Survivor. But then again, I never really thought we'd see Shin Megami Tensei combining with Fire Emblem either. So
no.
Who knows? Anything is possible. Regarding the Shadow of the Colossus thing, I remember when we first saw some of the stuff from Breath of the Wild, and there was like this one screenshot showing, we didn't know they were Divine Beasts at the time, but showing a Divine Beast lumbering in the background.
Right.
And I remember thinking, oh man, how cool would it be if this had some of the Shadow of the Colossus DNA, and as Link, you have to scale up the side of this thing before you go inside it. And that didn't end up being how it was, but there actually was sort of that component there. And it is something that I think they could explore. I'm not sure I want it to be with Slippery Ice Climbers, but I think there's probably something to Shu's idea, don't you think?
Yeah, and I can't really imagine them like sort of expanding on the Nana and Popo universe. like that just, I don't know. But Shadow of the Colossus is an amazing game in its own right. And I do like you said, the Divine Beast kind of has that just like sort of a nod to that. Especially when you're on a Divine Beast and you can kind of see everything moving around in the background. Definitely has a Shadow of the Colossus feel, but that's a stretch.
All right, on to our next letter, which comes from listener Brian Booth. It was very long, so I had to edit this one down. And he writes, I really enjoyed your chat about Breath of the Wild 6 months later, and I like the concept of revisiting it so much later down the road than some other shows did. And I'd like to weigh in. I like the Divine Beast for the most part, but for lack of a better word, they just didn't feel as solid as dungeons in previous Zelda games. My favorite boss encounter was inside a Divine Beast, though. I was at Death's Door when I figured out you had to throw a bomb to stun Fireblight Ganon. I also really enjoyed all four of the champion abilities. I feel like they were, for me, what helped the game cross the line from tense challenge to wild badass playground. My favorite mini-bosses were the Taluses, and I definitely prefer Lynels to Guardians. My favorite supporting characters were Cass and Mipha, so cool to hear you guys mention them. And my favorite region to explore was the Pharaon Jungle area. It just felt creepy, beautiful, and exotic compared to the other locales, and the nearby Lurlin village was one of my favorite Hylian towns. Like Hoth, I enjoyed Rito Village most of all among the others. As for my favorite, most memorable moment, it was my discovery of the secret room in the Island Labyrinth.
Oh, cool.
I do have one question for you and Pete, similar to the one you answered previously. Mario and Rabbids, by all appearances, shouldn't work, but it apparently does. I've heard some say that Shovel Knight and No More Heroes also shouldn't work, but it probably will because of the pedigree of the designers. Can you guys think of any other mashups that shouldn't work on their surface level, but the more you think about it, actually have the potential to be really awesome?
That's a good one. And I'm glad to hear that people enjoyed the Zelda episode.
Absolutely. Thanks for the kind words, Brian. As for his question, though...
What if you took Zelda and combined it with Cooking Mama?
Interesting. It's funny you should say that, because I was also thinking Cooking Mama combined with some Nintendo properties could be very interesting. I mean, it actually kind of makes sense with Breath of the Wild. I mean, you do so much cooking in that game that, it's already got a heavy element of that nature. But yes, Link probably could learn a thing or two from Cooking Mama and having some minigames inspired by that. So, yeah, I can see where you're coming from there.
Cool. What about you?
Well, the one I was thinking of was maybe Kirby combined with Cooking Mama.
Oh, wow.
Where, Kirby gets kidnapped by King Dedede, and he's forced to make delicious foodstuffs all day long. And so... Cooking Mama comes in to help him and trains him in the culinary arts to make all this delicious food. And then eventually he'll learn to make the super spicy curry to help him escape, I suppose.
That's so weird that we're both thinking Cooking Mama.
Or it could be Cooking Mama combined with Pokemon, and you play the bad guys and you are cooking up the Pokemon to make extremely exotic Pokemon dishes. But maybe that's just too morbid to discuss any further.
Yeah, I have a feeling that the Pokemon company would not be okay with that use of Pokemon.
Okay, I've got one more.
Okay.
unlikely combination, and that is Metroid combined with Chibi-Robo.
Wow. How would that work?
Well, the way I envision it, you know, Samus somehow finds Chibi-Robo, and Chibi-Robo is accompanying her on her missions, and so she winds up in some sort of environments where, you know, there's something, you know, going on, but, you know, she's too big to fit in there, even in Morph Ball form. So she sends in Chibi-Robo, and then Chibi-Robo goes inside these pipes and goes on the interior, and so he has his own, like, little quests, and, you know, he'll, maybe it's inside a, you know, some sort of machine, and that can open up a gateway forward or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so he can go into these, you know, sort of, you know, smaller, tighter areas where she can't fit, and by working together, they can get through a game. I mean, that would require Chibi-Robo to, you know, really up its platforming chops, but I don't know. I think there could be something to it.
You've got a lot of time on your hands, Hoffman.
That is very true, sadly.
Well, I have one more.
Okay.
What about Mario combined with the WWE?
Well, there hasn't been a Mario wrestling game yet, but maybe.
Well, so, you know, Nintendo made a wrestling game back on the NES called Pro Wrestling.
Oh, yes, they did. And I bring it up all the time.
And it never had a proper sequel.
No, it didn't.
And I think that, I think using the Mario characters in WWE could show how awesome that could be and, you know, lend itself well to its own spinoff.
Well, I think if there ever was a Mario wrestling game, I'd rather it not be involved with a WWE license. But I do like this line of thought. I would definitely like to see a Mario wrestling game or a Resurrection of Pro Wrestling. Either of those would definitely be up my alley.
Please look forward to it.
If only. Okay, our next letter comes from listener TJ McCart, and he writes, I thought I'd share the news that supposedly Nintendo is gaining more traction in China due to the announcement of Arena of Valor. Just figured this was interesting since you guys were one of the few podcasts to address this topic when I asked about it a while back. Thanks. And to this, I would say, TJ, I hope we didn't disappoint you too much by skipping over this one when it was announced last week on the Nintendo Direct. But yes, it was revealed. It is the first MOBA on Switch, and apparently it really is kind of a big deal overseas. Apparently it's actually making Nintendo's stock go up significantly. But yeah, it's free to play. It has classes such as warriors, mages, assassins, and marksmen, and it'll start as a beta test that's available this winter. Honestly, I didn't think it looked like, you know, something that I'd necessarily be up for, and, you know, it wasn't even a first-party title. However, I am glad it's coming out. I'm glad people are excited about it, and it is pretty cool to see it affecting Nintendo positively in that way.
Yeah, it's cool. You know, Nintendo isn't really known for certain genres, and MOBAs obviously being one of them, so any time that they kind of make an inroad on different franchises such as this, I think it's great news for Nintendo fans, because that just means more people will try the console out and potentially be a purchaser.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's kind of what I'm still waiting for, is for Nintendo themselves to get in on the genre.
Yeah.
This one is by a company called Tencent Games, but I'm still kind of holding out, waiting to see what Nintendo will do when they themselves create their own take on this genre. Yeah, hopefully it happens sooner rather than later, but for now, I'm glad to know this is going to be capturing people's attention.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, I think we should take an intermission now, and then we come back, we will discuss this week's big topic, which is Nintendo arcade games. All right, we are back, and we are ready to discuss this week's big topic, which is Nintendo arcade games.
Ooh.
Of course, last week, during the Nintendo Direct, Nintendo announced that several of their classic arcade titles were going to be coming to Switch in the form of Arcade Archives releases, courtesy of the publisher Hamster.
You're making that up.
Yes, it's Hamster, like the furry little creatures. But it's not made by Furry Little Creatures, it's just the name of the company that's doing these ports for Nintendo. And they have a pretty good pedigree. They've made all of these various SNK Neo Geo Arcade Archives games for the Switch. I feel like, you know, there's got to be like at least 50 of them out on the Switch now.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, they've made a ton of them on PlayStation hardware. They've made ports of Konami games, ports of Taito games. So they certainly know what they're doing when it comes to porting classic arcade titles. And we know that we're getting Mario Brothers versus Super Mario Brothers versus Balloon Fight versus Ice Climber versus Pinball versus Clue Clue Land and Punch Out, thanks to that Nintendo Direct. But we also found out, it was revealed earlier this week, that versus Excite Bike versus Wrecking Crew and versus Urban Champion are all on the way as well. Nice. So that's a whole lot of somewhat lost Nintendo history coming to the Switch.
Yeah, and it's cool to see this happen because...
Yeah, absolutely.
Other than this, you wouldn't really have a chance to sit down and play these games for any length of time, right?
Yeah, I mean, these games are very obscure in a lot of ways. They're hard to find. Arcades aren't really around that much anymore. And even compared to a lot of other games back in the day, they were somewhat hard to find. And so, yeah, it is really cool. And that's why I thought it was worth discussing as this week's big topic, to talk not only about those, but to talk about some other aspects of Nintendo's arcade history as well.
Yeah, and at first blush, I think that it looks like, well, okay, they're just re-releasing old games. But, you know, these games, a lot of them differ wildly from their console counterparts, right?
I don't know if I'd say wildly, but yes, there definitely are differences, and we will get to those as we sort of take a tour through Nintendo's arcade history.
All right, let's do it.
So, of course, you know, when I think Nintendo and most people think Nintendo, you know, you kind of think, well, maybe everything started with the NES and the Famicom, or maybe it started with the Game & Watch. Maybe you even heard of the TV games that they released in Japan. But, of course, before any of that stuff, they were doing arcade games. And it started in the late 70s with Computer Othello, which is that, you know, black and white circular token board game. And it was basically just a digital port of that. Nothing really exciting to write home about, kind of a very quiet, unassuming beginning for Nintendo's, you know, digital releases of that type. You know, the games they did after that were probably things you've never heard of, like Block Fever and Space Fever, which were pretty much just knockoffs of games like Breakout and Space Invaders. Again, not exactly what you would think of when it comes to one of the giants in our industry.
Right.
In addition to games like that, they also had a few more original games, such as Sheriff, which was this simple shooter where you had to pick off bandits. And you can find that homaged in Smash Brothers as well as WarioWare. So, you know, that one is maybe a little more known to modern audiences. And then there was also Radar Scope, which was another Space Invaders type game.
Right.
And I kind of think of that as one of their first really notable arcade games. Not because it was a big hit. In fact, it was anything but a big hit.
Right.
But, you know, it does have a lot of historical value. And so that's what I'm kind of hoping comes to the Arcade Archives series eventually, just because it is such an interesting title. It Right. was one of the first games worked on and developed by a Mr. Shigeru Miyamoto. I think he will go on to do great things one day. So, yeah, that's one that I think could definitely be worthwhile.
Now, Radar Scope is the one that they kind of bet the farm on, right? Like, they thought, well, this is going to be a big game, so let's ship a bunch of hardware out there and capitalize on that.
Well, I don't know if they bet the farm on exactly, but yes, you are correct. They thought it was going to be a big hit. And they had a bunch of these machines that they wanted to ship out across North America. This was part of their big splash of establishing Nintendo of America and making their mark over here in the U.S. However, it did not quite work out that way. And that's the other reason why this game is of such historical significance, because it was legendarily converted into Donkey Kong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not, you know, it's not like they just, you know, pasted the graphics or anything. They took the cabinets and they gutted them and changed them to make them into Donkey Kong. But yes, they had these unsold games they couldn't get rid of. So they're like, okay, we need something that really becomes a hit. What can we do? And that's when they decided to make Donkey Kong in 1981. And, you know, that did turn into a huge hit and kind of the rest is history. So for a lot of people, again, that might be where it feels like Nintendo's history really begins, with Mario and Pauline and this big old ape named Donkey Kong.
Right. Now, Chris, did you ever hear that that's why Nintendo of America is in Redmond, Washington? It used to be in New York when it originally was founded.
I knew that it was originally New York, but no, I wasn't quite sure of the story.
Yeah, so the story that I've read is that essentially, you know, they wanted to pick the headquarters to be, you know, obviously in New York, the biggest city in America.
But a big gorilla attacked it, and that's why it couldn't be there?
Yeah, exactly. No, what happened was they learned that shipping something from Japan to New York was not the easiest thing in the world. So what it would happen was you'd have to ship something from Japan to the west coast of America, and then by train ship it to New York. And then once it got to New York, then you could distribute it to arcades. Well, problem is that would be weeks. That could be, you know,
6 to 8 weeks,
and by that time you've lost your chance to have a hit. So that actually,
these arcade games weren't light. They're hard to ship around.
That's right. And so they actually decided to invest in some really cheap real estate over in Redmond, Washington, that is now, of course, also home to Microsoft. Mm-hmm. But they became, you know, sort of dependent on being closer to the homeland.
Okay. All right. Well, I did not realize that, but that does make a lot of sense. Yeah. Whoever you paste it, Donkey Kong came out, and it was absolutely a big old honking hit. Sold tons and tons of units.
Yep.
And of course, it was ported to all kinds of systems back in the day, including the NES. But you know, this is, of course, a game where the arcade version does differ quite a bit from what's generally been available.
Right.
If you were to play this game on the NES or most other systems, it was missing an entire level,
right,
the fabled pie factory, or the cement factory, as perhaps it is more properly called. But yeah, that was totally missing in the NES game.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's one of the first home to arcade ports. And you're saying, well, this is a great reason why I would love to get this in perfect arcade form on a modern piece of Nintendo hardware. Of course, the arcade version was emulated in Donkey Kong 64, and then there was the Donkey Kong Original Edition released on Virtual Console on 3DS. Although, even though it's called that, it's not really the Original Edition. It's still the NES edition,
right,
with the missing level added in, as well as some cutscenes. So I'm not sure why they didn't port the arcade game. But the rumor is that Nintendo had outsourced some of the programming on this game, and because of that, there's like some legal issue preventing the arcade Donkey Kong game from ever being re-released. So that is probably the reason that it has not been named as one of these arcade archives titles.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably the most obvious game that they could release.
Right.
Probably the game that's most deserving of a pixel-perfect port.
Right.
But if that rumor is true, that's the reason that we are not getting it yet. Yeah.
I'm actually totally okay with them not putting Donkey Kong on this, because I am terrible at that game. And for most people, I think that game is really, really hard. Unless you're, you know, Steve Wiebe or Billy Mitchell or Hank Chen.
Well, that's why they need to make it an arcade archives game. So instead of plunking in quarter after quarter, you can buy it for you know, some nominal fee, and you can sit down and practice. And then you'll be you know, reaching that kill screen on your own without losing all those quarters. So that's why I think it should come out. How about that?
Fair.
Of course, the game was such a hit that they followed up with Donkey Kong Jr. But unlike the original Donkey Kong, when they ported Donkey Kong Jr. over to their home systems, there were no major changes. There were no chopped out levels. You know, the main differences are visual. The arcade version had more colors. The screen was a little bit more compressed and had a little bit more of a vertical orientation. But for the most part, you know, the NES version does pretty well for itself.
Right.
On the other hand, another game that really does feel like an absolute lost classic would be Popeye.
Right.
I mean, probably a lot of people don't even remember that Nintendo made a Popeye game. And, you know, when you think about Nintendo, you don't really ever think of them ever doing licensed games like this.
No.
But, you know, they made a Popeye game.
So have you ever heard that Popeye actually was the game that they were originally going to make, and then when they couldn't secure the license, they actually went and made Donkey Kong?
Yes, I had. And, you know, you'll definitely notice the resemblance between the characters.
Right.
You know, Mario would be Popeye, Olive Oil would be Pauline, and then Bluto would be Donkey Kong. So there's definitely an analog there.
It's so funny.
So, you know, it certainly seems likely there is something to this story. You know, it didn't happen, and that's how we got Mario, so thank goodness for that.
Yeah.
But they did then secure the rights to Popeye, you know, like a year or two later.
Right.
And so then they made this, you know, sort of a platform action game. And you can't actually jump, so I don't know if platformer is really that accurate.
Right.
But anyway, you're walking around, you know, this single screen as Popeye. You're trying to navigate the area, collect these items dropped by Olive Oil. And, you know, of course, you can grab a can of spinach to make yourself temporarily invincible to the bad guys. This game did end up getting an NES port, but it still seems, you know, super rare. Like, I don't think I knew hardly anybody that owned that NES game. I know I played it, so I know I must have known somebody who had it. Otherwise, I never would have played it at all.
I've got a very guilty confession.
Oh?
Yeah, I own Popeye on NES.
You did?
Yeah,
I think... that's not guilty. I mean, that's kind of cool, because it is such a, you know, sort of obscure game.
Yeah, I think I was such, like, a Nintendo fanboy at even a young age that I, like, decided, you know what? If Nintendo made it, I've probably got to play it. And it was okay. It wasn't my favorite game for sure. It actually, in a lot of ways, as you mentioned, did remind me of Donkey Kong. Mm-hmm. The single screen, you know, trying to get invincible so you could then, you know, take on the bad guy. And there was a lot of parallels. But honestly, in the grand scheme of Nintendo games, it was probably one of the bottom tier.
Well, still, you know, I do find it very intriguing since it is one of their rare licensed games. And it is a game that we kind of, you know, never, ever hear about anymore. And then there was this arcade game that was based on, and the arcade version had superior graphics and animation. It actually took quite a big hit on the way to the NES when it came to the visuals. I mean, we're talking about, like, you know, 1983 visuals, so, you know, nothing to write home about by today's standards. But still, this is one that I would love to see them be able to bring back one way or another, whether it's the NES version or the arcade version. I suppose I'd just as soon have them do the arcade version, since that is the best-looking version of the game. But you know, obviously it would require them to make some sort of licensing agreement to get the Popeye license back, and, you know, chances are it's not worth whatever it would cost them. But still, if it's something that wouldn't break the bank, I would love to see it happen.
Yeah, maybe that sailor ship has sailed.
I see what you did there. Probably their big game after that, though, was Mario Brothers. And, you know, that's the game that is supposed to be hitting the Switch on September 27th as the inaugural Arcade Archives game. You know, this is the game that made Mario a plumber and introduced us to Luigi.
Mm-hmm.
And as Nintendo demonstrated on their video, you know, the arcade version had some changes to it in terms of graphics and animation. I think there was also another change in that the NES version was missing the icicles that fell from the ceiling of the platforms, but that was something that was in the original arcade game.
Right. I think that is something that there was in the original that it never made it to the home console.
So, yeah, that's going to be a, you know, a cool little nuance that we'll be able to re-experience when that game hits in the very near future. And it's really, you know, finding out all of these, you know, little nuances and just these small little things. I mean, oh, wow, look at this little thing that was in there that, you know, hasn't been in the NES version that I'm so familiar with. And, of course, that goes with all the other Versus titles as well. And, you know, unlike Donkey Kong and Mario Brothers, most of these Versus games I never had a chance to play firsthand in the arcade.
Right.
You know, I'm sure I played a couple of them, but, you know, most of them I never even saw, which makes it, you know, like doubly cool that I'll be able to, you know, play them, you know, essentially for the first time in this form. Apparently, a lot of these games were developed simultaneously for the arcades and for the NES, and so that's why they aren't direct ports of each other, because they had different teams working on them simultaneously, so they might share some aspects of it, but then there are some things that are just a little bit different. Like, Balloon Fight looks pretty much the same, whether you're talking about the arcade version or the NES version. I mean, the arcade version looks a little bit better, but aside from the visuals, the stages are like twice as high, and the enemies are more aggressive.
Right.
Also, a lot of these Versus games had, you know, two screens set up for two players simultaneous play. So it'll be interesting to see if you have an option for doing a split screen mode when the Arcade Archives version comes out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but aside from Balloon Fight, like, you know, versus Pinball had music, I understand, which the NES version didn't have. Wrecking Crew had a horizontal play field, and they used that for two-player simultaneous play.
Right.
And apparently you are constantly chased by Foreman Spike, who only harasses you occasionally in the NES version. Versus Excitebike, of course, has a two-player mode. And versus Urban Champion, you know, I'm not really sure of all the differences in there, but it has a score. I know that much, which the NES version didn't have.
Hopefully they made it a more fun game, I'm hoping.
You know, I wouldn't bet too much on that. Unfortunately, it's probably still going to be Urban Champion, but, you know, you never know.
Yeah, you never know.
You never know. On the other hand, you know, Punch-Out in the arcade had a lot of differences. This was the original Punch-Out. This is where it all came from.
Yep.
It started back in 1984, well before Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. It introduced the wireframe main character who may or may not be Little Mac. I think in Smash Brothers they said that was his original appearance, but is it really? I don't know.
Yeah, that one's a hard one.
But it, you know, it established that wireframe version of the character that is homaged in Smash Brothers, and it introduced us to characters like Glass Joe, Piston Hurricane, Bald Bull, and Mr. Sandman, as well as Kid Quick, who that was the inspiration for the Disco Kid in the Wii game.
Right.
As well as Pizza Pasta, who has never made a subsequent appearance in a Punch-Out title.
Well, maybe because his name is Pizza Pasta.
Perhaps so. But I don't know if that's any worse than, you know, some of the other names they have in Punch-Out.
So I feel like this is the version of Punch-Out that a lot of people remember.
Really?
Yeah, I do. It's funny because I remember hearing people talk about Punch-Out, and there's this, I don't know if you played this version, but
oh yeah,
there was an audio clip where they go, body blow, body blow.
Oh yes, yeah. Pretty much every time you punch someone, that's what it would say.
Yeah, and you know, I've heard people reference that when they talk about Punch-Out, and I'm like, well, that was definitely not in Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. It was definitely not in Super Punch-Out. That is 100% the arcade version.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting.
It is interesting because I don't know if I even knew that game existed until Mike Tyson's Punch-Out came out and I saw the ads on TV and stuff. But, you know, I discovered the arcade version later and, you know, it was something that I really wanted to play. And because I liked the NES game so much, I wanted to try out. And as I mentioned on the podcast last week, I always had issues because almost every version of the game I found was totally beat up and the controls were always wonky and loose and it was, you know, virtually unplayable. But, you know, aside from those technical problems I had, the game was really, really fun. It had, you know, the heart and soul of Punch-Out. It had, you know, these really large characters.
Right.
And it had, you know, these stacked monitors, kind of like a DS or a Game & Watch that was interesting and cool.
Funny, right?
You know, only had these six characters. You know, if you survive those six, it just cycles through them again and the game just, you know, goes on and on until you lose, I guess. Even so, this game seems, you know, long overdue for a home release. I'm really, really happy about this one. It's one of the ones I am most excited about.
Yeah, cool. I can't wait to play this and not have to like spend quarters and not have to just like linger in our arcade for too long.
Yeah, I mean, the only time that I ever see it these days, of course, is when they have like a classic arcade show or something like that. Other than that, I pretty much never see it. I am, of course, also really hoping that they'll decide to bring out Super Punch-Out, which, again, was the follow-up to this well before Super Punch-Out on the Super NES or the NES Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. They did a Super Punch-Out, and that's what brought a lot of the other classic characters, like Dragon Chan, Great Tiger, Super Macho Man, Vodka Drunkinsky, and your favorite character, Pete, Bear Hugger.
Need a hug?
Not from you. No, sorry.
How dare you.
Yeah, that was basically, you know, the same game as Punch-Out, just with these, you know, new and different characters. And it did add the ability to duck, but I think it was done by yanking up on the joystick, which caused even more damage to the controls.
Right.
It made it even harder to play that game than it did the original. So,
yeah,
as I've been saying, that's why I'm so looking forward to this, you know, arcade version, is because, well, if I'm playing with a Switch gamepad, it'll probably be a lot more responsive than these busted old arcade units I'm so used to encountering. Another one that I would really like to see them bring out would be Arm Wrestling, which was sort of a Punch-Out spinoff. Are you familiar with this one, Pete?
Arm Wrestling? No.
Yeah, it was a lot like Punch-Out in some ways. It had the same stacked dual monitors and the same types of quirky, cartoony characters. And one of the characters is even Bald Bull in a mask.
That sounds terrifying.
It certainly doesn't have quite the depth or appeal of Punch-Out, but it does have lots of crazy stuff going on, like one of your opponents is a robotic ape, and another one is Frankenstein's monster.
Hmm.
And you play the game by wiggling the joystick back and forth and mashing the buttons, but you still have to watch opponents' tells to see when they're going to throw counterattacks and stuff. And I've barely played the game, so I really don't remember it, but it's one that's never had a port. And maybe it's not like the best, most suitable game for a home conversion, but I would still love to see it brought back as an Arcade Archives title.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds fun.
And then I guess that brings us to a game that I'm also much looking forward to, and that is Versus Super Mario Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
As I was saying before, there are a lot of differences compared to the NES version. This one is a lot harder. There's different places of power-ups, different placement of enemies, and even more beyond that. Did you play this one much yourself in the arcade?
I definitely remember playing it, but then I remember, spending a lot of quarters on it being like, why am I doing this? But at the same time, I definitely remember that there were different things about it. Nothing stands out in my mind completely, but I do remember just like little nuances that because everyone knows Super Mario Brothers like by heart almost. So when anything's out of place, it just seems completely different.
Yeah, now I pick up on all the specifics, way back in the day, because I think I probably played it before I actually owned an NES. I had experienced the NES at my cousin's place and at some friends' houses, and then I remember going to this hamburger joint and my brother's like, hey, it's a Super Mario Brothers machine, and he was playing it, and then I played it. But I remember, I'm like, oh, I don't remember the placement of this block being here in the NES version. But I looked into it, and it turns out there are even more changes than I realized. Mm. How a lot of the levels in Super Mario Brothers, come back later on as like harder versions.
Yep.
Well, apparently in Versus Super Mario Brothers, you just get that hard version right away. There is no easy version.
Oh man.
And then the later level where you encounter that harder version has been replaced by a completely different level, which is actually from the Lost Levels, from the Japanese Super Mario Brothers 2, I never realized back in the day. I'm not even sure if I ever got to any of those levels back in the day.
Well, that's the thing about a lot of these arcade games is that they were designed to kind of like take your quarters. they wanted to make them more difficult than the home version. So it is kind of funny. But it will be nice to get a chance to like be able to play these on your own time with unlimited amount of times to retry.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a much harder, much more challenging version that really mashes up the original Super Mario Brothers with the Lost Levels. And I'm not sure which actually came first, whether this came out first or the Japanese SMB2 came out first. But any way you look at it, it's a very, very different and interesting take on Super Mario Brothers. And again, a lost piece of history. It's going to be making a comeback, and so I am all for it.
Yeah, it is cool that, it's almost like this version of Mario that has just all but disappeared.
Yeah, completely.
So in a way, it's kind of like this piece of history that, people get the chance to own again. So I'm looking forward to picking this up.
Yep, I am definitely excited for it myself. This wasn't, of course, the end of Nintendo's arcade history. There were lots of other games they made. There are lots of things we didn't touch on, such as their sports games, like the arcade versions of golf and baseball, and their light gun games, such as Wild Gunman, which will live on forever thanks to Back to the Future 2.
And Hogan's Alley.
And then their arcade presence persisted with stuff like, the arcade version of Killer Instinct, and even on to arcade versions of stuff like F-Zero and Mario Kart. So, despite not really being known for arcade games, Nintendo actually has had a pretty decent arcade presence over the years, and it's one that we certainly are very excited about making a comeback.
Yeah, and I think it would be cool to see some of the other companies' arcade stuff that Nintendo sort of had was in cahoots with, like some of the iREM stuff, maybe.
Oh yeah, Nintendo did, you know, bring Kung Fu onto the NES, which was originally an IRM arcade game, and that's another game that's sort of been totally lost to time, say around Virtual Console or anything. So yeah, it'd be really nice to see some of their old stuff arrive in arcade archives form, along with titles like Kid Nicky and R-Type. Yeah, there's a lot of room, I think, for other companies to do this arcade archive stuff. So hopefully some others follow Nintendo's path and do it. With that said, I guess it is time to wrap up this episode of the podcast. But before we go...
Don't leave me hanging, Chris. I need to hear what's happening with Captain N.
That's right. We have time for another dramatic reading, and it is continuing the supposed adventures of Captain Nintendo. Previously, there was an explosion at Nintendo headquarters caused by a cup of piping hot coffee. A Metroid game was paused, a game pack came to life, and Brett Randall's gained special powers. And now, the saga continues. This is incredible, Terra, but Emerald's right. I can feel it, Brett said. Watch this. Brett then raised his hand, and the entire room was bathed in a really ugly yellow-green glow. That's pretty good, commented Emerald, but it's a really ugly yellow-green glow. Give him a break, said Terra protectively. It's his first time. Sorry, said Emerald. By the way, with your color powers, you can cast the illusion that you're wearing different clothing. You mean like a costume or something? Asked Brett. If that's what you want, came the reply. Brett considered this new notion for a few moments as he glanced around the room. Gathering ideas from the jump boots Samus was wearing, Brett fashioned the illusion of an impressive pair of super high tops with screaming yellow and purple designs. The matching costume was equally impressive. Even a person just inches away from him would not be able to tell the illusion from the real thing. This is all so amazing. I feel so powerful, said Brett. And I can really bring video characters and objects to life? Temporarily, reminded Emerald. You'll be like a captain, Terra christened, of the whole Nintendo universe. Whoa, wait until Max gets a load of this, said Brett. Say, where is Max anyway? Terra asked. Yeah, he should have been back, started Brett. Probabilities indicate that now would be a real good time to explain about that other thing, said Emerald. Other thing? Asked Terra. That's right, said Brett to Emerald. You mentioned another thing that was a result of the explosion. What did you mean by that?
Bum, bum, bum.
That's right. We will find out just what Emerald meant by that, but not until next episode.
Man.
You think you can wait that long?
No. I want some high tops with cool powers, too.
Well, you just have to go back to Nintendo, get caught in an explosion caused by piping hot coffee, and maybe we can see what we can do then.
Right.
But other than that, I'm not sure I can help you out.
Well, thanks, Chris.
Yeah, sorry. You'll just have to be content with listening to this exciting story of Captain Nintendo.
I think it's just the way you tell it.
Anyway, that does it for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com, and you can follow us at PowerProsPod on both Facebook and Twitter. You can follow me, The Hoff, on Twitter at Chris The Hoff, and you can find Pete at Burly Red Yeti. You can email us at powerprospod@gmail.com for any reason, and of course, it would be great if you liked the podcast and wanted to give us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Pete Michaud.
Konnichiwa!
And Mega Man's human little buddy, Lan Hikari.
Jackin!
We will see you next time.